Hey folks, for today's show, this is the second part of a recording of a live show that we did in July 2025. The live show was essentially a sort of a debrief and responding to questions and thoughts that had come up from the Pan Political series. And for today's episode, we're starting in at episode 3. Just a couple of notes before we get into it. Today's show in particular, it's probably going to make much more sense if you go back to what is episode 91 in the feed, otherwise known as the first of the Pan Political series, released in January 2025. That's just going to make way more sense of this material. Second note is there's an ad coming up for a course I'm running quite soon, so that's starting in September 2025, so if you're interested, you want to get onto that quickly. I've had quite a few people asking questions around trying to gauge if it's going to be right for them. The course is A Therapist's Guide to Sexuality, Taboos and Kink. And people have been wondering, is that going to be like too much sex for where I'm at? Is it going to be too much psychology for where I'm at? Is it going to be too much process work for where I'm at? So conveniently, I did a free 1-hour webinar on it that you can watch now for free. And there's a link to that in the show notes and on the Curious Creatures website. Okay, so with those notes out of the way, let's get into it. We're picking up here after the group has come back from a break and some small group exercises. Welcome back, all. So the third episode, to recap the material we covered there. So I wanted to... Yeah, I started with clarifying something about toxic masculinity, and sometimes the phrase is used as if to say, all masculinity is toxic. It's not the way it was intended. It is to say that what we're looking at there, that specifically, is a toxic expression of masculinity. And so the idea there is that perhaps some would say there's a fair bit of that around. There's a fair bit of toxic masculinity, some would say. And I would suggest that, or there's a philosophy that suggests that something happens to men sometime between they're born. Like, not many of them are actually born toxic and dangerous, but something happens between then and the time that they are exhibiting behavior traits which are toxic and dangerous or something like that. And so, again, I propose that we need to get interested in, like, it's not enough just to articulate bad male behavior. We need to get interested in and understand why that's happening and what exactly we as a society are doing to make men behave the ways they do. And essentially, I propose that a toxic expression of masculinity is achieved when we suppress male feelings, when we suppress male complaints, when we suppress needs, and when we suppress vulnerabilities. So this approach may have started with, let's say, patriarchy. I know not everyone agrees with that particular description of a model, and others do. That's okay. But let's say that toxic masculinity began with patriarchy. That may be the case. But in this episode, I suggested that we collectively have sort of picked up that role of enforcing toxic masculinity. There's way more in it in the episode, but, you know, we do it through jokes about men, the role models of masculinity that we roll with, and how we respond to male needs, which is mostly a version of shut up, or worse yet, man up on a collective scale. And so my thoughts, and again, I want to hear your thoughts on any of this in a minute, but my thoughts on where to from here is I think we need to respond with care, empathy, and interest to any group that speaks out about their needs. My guess is at the moment we do an okay-ish job on this with regards to women and women's issues. But when we only respond to women's issues as the important ones, we are ironically contributing to toxic masculinity. On screen, we need to stop casting men as the butt of jokes or as incapable goofs or as heroes of an unachievable level for the average person. All of those things just create a world where, as a man, you just don't want to have feelings. We need to stop describing bad jokes as dad jokes. again, it just creates a world where, as a man, you just don't want to have feelings, let alone crack a joke. I myself have never cracked a joke, so that doesn't apply to me, fortunately, but I can imagine for other people it might. And I think also this is a bit of a funny one, but we need to create, or we need to allow access to, spaces that regard participants as sacred. So there's spots where men gather, and there's spots where women gather. And I'm so sorry throughout this entire conversation that so much of it is in the binary. We're responding to a binary gender political world. But to continue, we also create spaces that are more likely to only include minority genders, such as non-binary, agendered, trans, etc. However, within those spaces, and to sort of come back to the binary a little bit, women, I think, are much better at creating spaces where the participant is sacred. And I think that does incredible things for the worth and self-esteem of women. And it means that they're less likely to be exhibiting what I guess you'd call toxic femininity, not a term you hear very often. Whereas a lot of the spaces that are male only, they're not spaces that are revolving around the idea that you as a participant are sacred for who you are. They're more likely to be a workplace or a sports space or something, or a happenstance space or something like that. So I think a lot of undoing toxic masculinity is creating or allowing men to have access spaces to spaces where participation is sacred, where they are sacred. Yeah, that's my thoughts. Over to you. Any thoughts on any of that material?
I had a facetious thought that then evolved into kind of when, oh, actually. And so you talk about children aren't born toxic and dangerous. And I thought about my youngest nephew, who certainly smells toxic and is definitely a danger to himself. And then I was like, hang on, but clearly there's a process, and from some point have child is created and is a more or less blank slate, putting genetics aside, and then we end up with someone that we don't like at the end or someone that we do like at the end. And that's it then made me reflect on my older nephew, who is currently 4, and so very much into kind of categorizing things and learning his place in the world and all that sort of stuff. And I remember being at the dinner table and him counting how many men there were and how many women there were, and then it was, oh, the boys win, there's more boys than girls, but in this kind of, there was an aggressive tone behind it all. He's got this kind of hyper competitive, everything is competitive, and so it was really strange to kind of sit there and feel that toxicity, like the seed of the toxicity in this 4-year-old, and I'm like, what the fuck is happening at your nursery? Like, because that's not representative of my perception of his parents' behaviors or anything. So I'll stop there.
That was a great point. It gets me to thinking about, like, I think if you took a really quick poll of the general population without a whole lot of thinking about it first, I honestly think that people might say, oh, like about half of men are just like born a little bit rotten, or maybe a lot rotten, and half of them are okay. So by and large, it sort of makes sense just to treat them all as one. So many of them are bad. But I think socialization kicks in so much earlier and so much more strongly than people give a credit for. So two studies that came across my desk separately, I spoke about this a little in the podcast, but I've never seen anyone except myself put them together. One of them showed that, so with little bubba things, you know how up until a certain age, I don't know what it is, maybe it's 6, maybe it's 12 months, something like that, it's actually very hard to pick the sex, the biological physical sex of a baby. They kind of look the same. So this is kind of like, oh, congratulations on your thing. And then at a certain age, they start to look like a male thing or a female thing. The first study got plastic dolls of quite a young age and swaddled them in blue, i.e. implying that they were blue. And all that the mission was said to the participants was just like, oh, just hang out with the baby for 5 minutes. We're just going to record, see what happens. And then you give exactly that same plastic doll but swaddled in pink to the same participants, or a B group of participants, and observe what happens. And the differences are profound. The pink dolls are more likely to be held close. They're more likely to be cooed and spoken to in sweet, generous tones. And they're more likely to have love expressed to them. The ones swaddled in blue are held at a further distance, they're more likely to be spoken to sternly and authoritatively and so forth. Like the difference, even at that incredibly young age, is profound at such a, at a point in time where those baby humans are trying to learn so much about the world around them. So that's one study. The second study shows things like mice that are not licked and held and cooed and breastfed and all those sorts of things by their mother wind up more violent and more aggressive, just absolutely consistently. And it's very hard to repeat that exact same experiment with children, but we know if you look at that on more zoomed out sociological trends, you can spot those same behaviors. So we as parents at such a young age are helping to create toxic masculinity right back there. And so many people would skip over that and say, well, that's just the way men are, not realizing that there's the difference in how we treat men and women that starts at such a young age. So I love your thoughts. Thanks for that, Dan. Robbie.
Well, I've got this more personal reflection that actually ties into what you just said. Sort of like being able to reflect on it. I was the child of a single mum in the 70s. I was the stereotypical act like a man, boys don't cry, you're stereotypical man, you're just like your father kind of thing. Looking back, it kind of lays the seed for that toxic behavior. I realize now that my birth giver was surrounded by a community of women who were in the position where they were all divorced, separated and bringing up children on their own. And that created an echo chamber, for want of a better word, on this behavior. And sort of looking back here, this is things I've spoken about before, written about before, is who were our role models, the men, male role models growing up during this time. You know, typical man. So, okay, I'm a typical man. What does a typical man look like? Does he play football? Does he play cricket? Is he privileged enough to get away with his indiscretions? He drinks a lot. He gets out. He goes out for a fight on the weekend. These were my typical male role models growing up. You look at people like Bernie. Like, he was drinking, was it 48 cans of beer on a flight to London, and that was considered a hero. Really toxic behavior. I mean, this is what we grew up with, and this is what modeled behaviors. And I think my second question on it is, where do we begin to change that? Because there's a whole generation of Gen X's men growing up who had that exact same experience. And where do we begin to change those behaviors? That's kind of what I'm doing now. But yeah, just a reflection on that. And how it ties back into the toxic behavior. We have to own it. Yes, we have toxic behavior, but it's not just because of what I mean. It's just toxic behavior.
Right. Yeah. Thank you for raising that point. I think maybe we need to do a little awareness raising around if you are in a culture where you have essentially rejected men from your community and you've adopted I don't need them around, they're of no benefit to me, and you find yourself the parent of a boy, I think that does create a really interesting situation which we need to get more aware around. In my experience, that environment can create really broken men with shatteringly low self-esteem. And it can also create men who, in my experience, have been the worst misandrists that I've ever dealt with. So the people that hate me the most for bringing up this sort of material and being compassionate and warm and caring and understanding towards men as well as women, oftentimes have come from the kind of environment you speak of. I want to straight away jump in and go into defense for single mums, though, in particular, and single parents generally. This is not a roundabout way of saying you have to have both participants of a hetero parenthood in your life to be healthy. It is not saying that at all. But particularly if we have also kicked men out of childcare roles, if they're basically non-existent in primary schools, and in all the other situations that a child is likely to be exposed to in those younger years, then I think as a parent, one needs to be mindful that there is some level of exposure to good men, if we're talking about boys, and women, if we're talking about girls. And I am just absolutely delighted to be thinking about an example of someone I was chatting with a few weeks back who we were just catching up, which are radio. So what are you up to this week? They're like, I forgot their exact language. I'm off to hang out with, I think they said my boy or something like that. This is a male person that I was chatting with. I was like, oh, I didn't know you had a kid. And they're like, no, I don't. I was like, oh, is it like is it like an aunt, uncle kind of a situation or cousin or some other kind of obligation? Like, no. And eventually they're just like, yeah, that's just like a friend of mine who realized they were in a bit of a situation, like a single mum to a boy, and realized that they didn't have a whole bunch of people around. And they're a friend of mine. So we just started to lean in a little bit to this idea of it takes a village, takes a community to raise a kid. And it's not a ton. I just catch up with this kid. Like, it's a solid commitment. It's an important commitment in my life. It's my love and my community service or whatever it is. But I will not break my whatever it is, my fortnightly hangout time or whatever. And the friend of mine spoke about it very beautifully and caringly. They love it. As a non-parent themselves, it gives them a space to get the joys and the benefits of that parenting role. And obviously such incredible benefit to the child and the single parent concerned. And I mean, it just so happens that I think that the friend in question is adorable, like in terms of this question of like, where do you find good male role models? It's just talk about winning the jackpot. But yeah, so I'm delighted that to see that solutions are not just possible, but like really joyous and a win-win for all parties. But yeah, I think we need more awareness that the current approach we're taking of like, let's just get men the hell out of everywhere, as per that article we were talking about at the start of today, is just setting up a generation of problems going forwards. Phew, I didn't realize I was so passionate about that one. David, and then maybe we'll move on.
On the balance of things, I probably regard myself as mostly less than a toxic male. I was brought up with my three sisters and mother and a mostly absent father. So, and maybe because of that, not that I was ever put down as being male, but I think I started to have a perspective of seeing toxic masculinity early on. And I've been aware of that and kind of like as another male, felt somehow responsible for that. And I think, yes, we can tend to be put all in the one basket. It's like there are toxic males and you're male and somehow it's your fault or you're responsible. At least I've felt the burden of that all my life. I've felt sometimes, oh, I'm sorry, I've got to do this as I'm a man and therefore I don't have a right to say something that even to the point of in my teens or late early 20s, like being very cautious about approaching women for dates or whatever because of the fear of being seen as a predator. And it's only recently, and particularly with this podcast, Rog, that we can, there's way more subtlety. I mean, we tend to see things in black and white and up and down and male and female, that the gender debate is way more nuanced than that. And I think, and that's sort of been a breath of fresh air. It's been a release, and I'm starting to sort of feel like, look, it's okay or more okay about being who I am. But I think if you've got that constriction and that mask, then it's harder to be your authentic self. And my authentic self includes some of those so-called masculine traits. And I feel like, oh, is it okay if I'm a bloke?
Yeah. Thank you for speaking to that. You have many good points. Thank you. One of them that I want to speak to is around the sense that even if you yourself are not a bad example of maleness or masculinity, on some levels, your responsibility to deal with the ones that are or something like that, or men should sort out men problems or something like that. I just like to speak to that little bit of it. Person A will sometimes say something like that, like you men should sort this out, and on some level, this is your fault and responsibility, even if just as an extension of the privileges you have, then surely you should shoulder the burden of sorting this problem out as well, which I can kind of relate to. I can kind of relate to a lot of that. A lot of times it gets a reaction from person B who will say, oh, I thought we were moving to a world where we're responsible for our actions as opposed to being judged by the actions of the rest of our gender or something like that. Like women in the 70s were essentially saying, we want to be judged as individuals, not limited by our gender, social norms or whatever. Sometimes there's a reaction like that. But if you skip over that, if you ignore that, and if this role says, all right, like fair enough, I might actually, like, I do recognize I have some privileges, and maybe in some ways I am at fault for some of these things in some ways, in some roundabout ways, because these things play out in really murky ways, even if I did not go and punch someone in the face. Maybe I'm a part of a system and I have privileges, and on some levels I've turned a blind eye or created a society that makes it possible for someone to go and punch someone else in the face or something like that. So if person B leans into that and says, yeah, you know what, I'm going to have a look at this, there's a whole variety of things that they might do. They might start running men's groups. They might just start with men's behavior change groups, but they might then move on to men's groups. They might do reading, whatever else. There's a whole bunch of things. But there's a couple of really funny, not funny at all, but there's a couple of funny traps that are going to come up at some stage.
Yeah.
Either person B is going to go, as I've sort of been doing with this podcast, sort of began, you know what? I've looked into it. I've discovered what's going on for those men that are causing the problems, and they are in strife. They are a long way from just rolling around in their privilege. They need help. And at that point in time, person B will come back and say, you must be joking. Women are the victims here. Women need more resources in society. We'll get to your problems, in quotes, once we've sorted out the real problems. Shut the fuck up. And by the way, you've now been banished from the in crowd. Yeah. So I think that's a really nasty dialogue that comes out of a really divisive world. And I think it's a flaw in the sense that you people over there should sort it out. I suggest that we all need to sort out these things together. And I think it's also a fault that flows out of the sense of, this is more something when I was growing up, we're using different language now, but when I was in my younger years, we would often use the phrase, men need to pick up their inner feminine. And it gets really interested when you look into what exactly does my inner feminine mean. One of the qualities of feminine is vulnerability, and recognizing ways that you and your gender have been fucked over, and recognizing ways that you need help. Like, that's kind of the opposite of masculine. So that leads you down the same path where you lean into your feminine and you go, ah, you know what I've discovered? I've discovered some needs. But then when you speak up about that, person A will look back and go, oh, that is not what we meant when we said discover your inner feminine. Yeah. The next episode, fourth episode, is on gender separate spaces. And I got to say, by the way, I think that this is probably the most juicy episode out of a lot of them for a lot of people. And I think that that's the case because gender separate spaces are incredibly important to people. Like, a lot of people have gotten a lot of benefit from gender separate spaces. So anything that raises questions around that or points out that there might be some downsides is automatically up against something which is of incredible benefit. So I think a lot of people have like a lot of reactions to this episode. And I can slightly tell that slightly from the conversations I've had around me, but also just from the crew's overall numbers I've got. Like, I've got a vague sense of which episodes get listened to more than other ones. And yeah, this one has been listened to more than most. Also, I think our gender identity is pretty central and core to a lot of people. And some of what I was speaking about in this episode is almost like gender denialism, or starting to de-emphasize our gender identity. And that also is really central for almost all people. Like, unless you've actually opted into being non-binary, like myself, almost everyone else is very reluctant to surrender anything about their gender identity. That's a little bit of an overstatement, but I think you get my point. So to summarize this episode, I'm suggesting that a gender separate space is any space or any group where a specific gender is excluded, or where the group itself is made up of a specific gender group. So you might have like a men's group that excludes women and minority genders or something like that. Or you might have a group which is just for women. Yeah. And so I'm talking, for these purposes, I'm talking about all of them. And it makes you realize just how gender separate we are as a society. I'm talking about everything from like a girls' or a boys' night out through to single-sex schools, through to everything in between. A lot of this content, though, is especially relevant to any group that has some kind of a supportive or therapeutic role. I think that's where the differences really come up. And I articulated a lot of drawbacks. I identified how supportive and how important these groups are for people, which puts us in a real dilemma. And my position is not that we should get rid of them, but that we do need to address the problems that flow from them. And I haven't yet heard a whole lot of solutions. Some of the drawbacks are pointed out, and I think I broke them down into 14 categories of problems or something like that. But some of the important ones that bubble up for me is that when we are in gender separate spaces, we don't hear other stories about what happens because of gender. If I'm in a men's group, I'm missing out on very, very important women's stories and vice versa. And also, women are missing out on what happens when they see that their story is being heard by me as a male presenting person. Also, if we agree with the idea that men and women, sorry about the binary, but if we agree that men and women have got privileges and that privileges need to be shared, if we're doing a lot of our work and a lot of our moving in gender separate spaces, then we are stunting the sharing of those privileges. We're in the way of that sharing. Particularly with groups that do have some kind of element of being emotionally supportive. So if they're a therapeutic, like a wild woman group or discover your sexuality or whatever else, or any kind of emotional supportive group, then they create the dynamic where we feel like we are only safe to explore those topics and ourselves and our vulnerabilities with other people exactly like us. If we do that work in mixed gender spaces, it introduces the reality that we can do that work with other people present. But if we only do it with people like us, then it creates a sense that we can only do it with people like us, which I think hugely contributes to the gender war. And yeah, as a spin out from that, we create a situation where there's no amount of self-development or self-awareness work or careful behavior that a person from the other group can do. They will always be unsafe, no matter how safe they actually are in reality or in person. Just having them in the space makes the space unsafe, according to that model. So they're kind of just like my main concerns with gender separate spaces. I've cut out the 12 or so minor points. I just want to drop in with three extra points that I made in the original series regarding gender separate spaces, but I kind of missed here in the recap, but I reckon they're worth a mention. The first point is a risk with all groups that are built around some form of separation, which is that we sort of can't help but to wind up being in a bubble of information and opinions and so forth. We can't help but to get one-sided, and we can't help but to lose the checks and the balances that might be provided by having people around that were of different opinions and having diversity itself around. The second point is that gender separate spaces, they play into our differences rather than what we have in common. And personally, for my money, I suggest that the gender war is already hot enough, and it's time for us to focus on what we have in common and to come together more. I think we'd all get along better that way. And the third point is that if what we want is male behaviour change, and you know, arguably that's a huge part of what we're seeking in gender equality and the gender movements, we're essentially saying that we want men to be more like women. But by creating women's spaces, we then take away men's access to what we are wanting them to learn. So some of them work it out anyway. So it does sometimes work, but many don't. And many wind up worse than they began. They wind up in the hands of people who, in various ways, are actually harming women. So ironically, sort of almost sounds like I'm speaking as a woman here. I'm just sort of taking a side as opposed to changing gender on you. But ironically, we sort of become our own worst enemies with that approach, even though in some ways it makes sense in the moment at the time. If you flip the situation around, the same thing happens with male spaces, and women have known that for a long time. Like, it's long been recognized that male-only institutions have long been places that have enabled men to hold on to their power and to keep women out of those spaces. But I would say, fortunately, we are making a great deal of progress on that. The job is not done, but we are making a great deal of progress. And I guess my point is simply, yeah, at the moment, we're sort of celebrating the fact that the same thing is happening in reverse. It's funny watching this. I've made a few references throughout this podcast series to what is happening with American politics and the Democrats. And, you know, there's more going on than this, but there has been a bit of shock and disbelief around the degree to which the Democrats lost the most recent election in the United States. And obviously there's many reasons for that. There's many elements that play into it. But one element that's been recognized is that male voters, and in particular younger male voters, have left the party and they've wound up in the hands of, or they've been voting for Donald Trump. There's absolutely, for me, nothing surprising about this. I mean, that just reflects a broader trend that's happening in that the pro-women's movement and the women's movement are effectively saying, men, go away and sort this out. We don't like you here. And so then it's been, to me, absolutely no surprise whatsoever that those people, or let's say those voters, have wound up ironically sort of doing what we've told them to do. They've gone away. But rather than magically coming around and being supporters and picking up their inner feminine and not being such bad men or something like that. Ironically, what's happened is this is a really good example of they've just gone off to the other side, because at least the other side isn't criticizing them so much, isn't angry with them so much, and is acknowledging and validating their issues. In response to that situation, and I don't have visibility over the entirety of it, but I know there are some campaigns to try and work out what language to use to speak to younger men by the Democrats to try and win them back. To which I would just say, look, I don't think it's a language thing. I think we need to stop telling them to go away, or said in the positive, welcome them back and they will come back. I don't think young men want to wind up in conservative right-wing or far right-wing groups. They just want to be welcomed back. But I think that presents an incredible challenge for the Democrats, because on some level, you've got to say, hey, you men, we respect your issues. You're welcome here. Come over here and talk. It'd be effective, but I just don't think that the Democrats, and arguably the broader gender movement, is in a spot where we are ready to do that just yet. So yeah, my point is, if what we're wanting is male behavior change, just telling them to go away is not proving to be a very effective way of achieving that. And my suggestions on potential ways forwards is, I think we need to make sure that we don't do things separately just because it's easier, or because it lets us off our edge or lets us off the hook with regards to our diversity work. Like, if we're more comfortable with people like us, and that's the decisions, that's the grounds on which we're creating a gender separate space, that may or may not be great reasoning. So in the same way that we need to question diversity issues in, say, workplaces, in government, in family units and everything else. I think we need to extend that to everything. The first thing that comes up when we talk about this stuff often for groups is safety. People will often say, well, I have to run a gender group for safety reasons. That's by far the most common feedback I receive. I think if there are safety issues, that's often the end of the conversation. Like personally, when I have this conversation and people say safety, especially if they say, you wouldn't get it, Rog, because you're a man, it's very hard to proceed with that conversation. Like I'm out at that point in time. It's very hard to come back from. But I think in a perfect world, it would be great to question, well, exactly what safety are we talking about? Because at first glance, it's like, if I run this with men, I'm going to get taken down and punched in the face at some stage. It's like a physical safety thing is how it sounds. And if anyone questions or pushes back against that, it's like, what are you in support of violence against whatever, men, women, minority genders, which of course I'm not. But I think in a perfect world, we do need to question exactly what safety issues we're talking about. And rather than just go, oh, there's a safety issue, so let's just cut out a gender, I think we say, is there any other way that we can address that? So in almost all groups that I'm in my bubble, in my world, it's never about that kind of physical violence that we're talking about. It's about other things which are sort of safety, but maybe not safety. A lot of them is just comfort. Like if we've got men in our women's group, they're going to say stupid things, or they're going to say awkward things, or they're going to hit on us. So there's sort of safety, but there's sort of just awkwardness and discomfort, which I get it, they're real. But I think all of those things can actually be tackled in different ways addressed for what they are, as opposed to just chucking them out under the general banner of safety. So some of that comes down to just being really clear and specific and articulate about this is not a pickup, and do not dare start cracking on to people in this space. This is a space for emotional vulnerability, sharing and development. And if we've got sexual tensions at play, it's going to ruin that dynamic. So it doesn't take a huge amount of time to say something like that, but that's very clear. Also, if the concern is something like, say, well, men are not so up to speed with this material, so they're starting from scratch. That's going to be true and not true. It's an incredible generalization. If the concern is you want people of a certain standard or a certain level, then maybe it's time you vetted all participants, because some men are going to be extraordinary at that stuff and some women are not going to be. Likewise, if you're doing something way out at the different end of the scale, like you're running a four-wheel drive club, don't do that on gender lines either, because some men are going to be shit four-wheel driving and some women are going to be better than you. So if you're worried about like acting at a certain level, don't use gender as a sort of a shortcut or a cheat or a placeholder. Like get a vetting process in place and you're going to have a much better quality group. So yeah, in short, I think men need to welcome women into areas where men have traditionally got societal and structural privileges, and women need to welcome men into areas where women have got psychological privileges. I also think, and I'm nearly finished, by the way, I'll throw to you in just a second and then we'll move towards finishing up. I also think a part of this does go hand in hand with almost like willful denial about gender differences. I feel like we're living at a time at the moment, maybe we have throughout the history of time, and maybe it's time we moved on, or maybe I'm completely wrong about this, but I feel like we're living in a time where a lot of us are celebrating gender differences to the point where we often talk like, let's just go with men and women, like they are different species. And it's actually bewildering that we manage to get along and talk at all. I feel like that's where a lot of people are at in the world around me at the moment. And I think that there's actually a lot of benefits from willfully denying that. I mean, I think just as a simple fact, there is more difference within gender groups than there are between gender groups. So if you've got a bell curve of behaviors, whatever, pick any behavior trait you want, a bell curve of how men fit with that and a bell curve of how women fit with that, you're right. The average might be, no, the average is going to be a little bit different. And whether that's through socialization or birth is a whole other conversation we can have. But sure, maybe on average there's a bit of a difference. But the point is that bell curves overlap. Most people overlap to varying degrees. And I've used this example on the podcast. People who are into celebrating gender difference almost kind of imply that I would have more in common with someone born 5,000 or even 50,000 years ago who happens to be male, because that person has almost the identical brain to me. Like almost nothing has changed evolutionary in that time frame. So based on that model of like, we are completely different people, men are from Mars, women are from Venus, it's a miracle that any of us get along, then I should be able to magically just slide into a conversation with someone from 50,000 years ago, which we all know is completely stupid. Because the thing that's changed from now to then is socialization. I say socialization is almost everything. And the difference between people of different genders who are otherwise in a similar cultural social environment is almost nothing. And if it, even if there is something, it can be, fortunately, the plasticity of our brains allows us to overcome a lot of that stuff quickly. So I don't know what your Facebook feeds are like, but in mine or in my news feeds, I'm forever getting articles written along the lines of what women want from men or what men want from women. The 10 things that a man needs to see in a woman. Shit like that. Which just frames us as different species. I think we need to be writing articles on what people want from people, what people want from relationships or what people want from sex, because it turns out it's all the same. Maybe we have some socialized difference. Maybe there's even 2% of genetic differences in there, but it's so much the same. I think we need to move away from language that constantly reminds us about gender. And that, by the way, is the main reason I identify as non-binary. So I prefer to be spoken to as a they or a them. I mean, I don't care. Call me whatever you want. But that is the reason that I think about the world as they, them. And that's the reason I like to be spoken about as they, them, because I don't like to be reminded of my gender every time we speak. And I don't like you to be seeing me through a gendered lens every time you look at me. I want to be judged on my actions as an individual. I'm in a male body, and it's great, by the way, thank you for asking. But in terms of my makeup and my psychology and the soft stuff, I prefer to think of myself as non-gendered. I think we need to remember that just because we might know someone's gender, that doesn't mean we know anything about them as a person. Like, it actually tells us nothing. And I think we should remember that we cannot have equality of access if we're also celebrating difference. So if we're going through a time of celebrating differences, like men are more like this on average, women are more like that on average, if we're kind of getting off on that at the moment or celebrating it, we are always going to be fighting against equal opportunity. So we're always going to have different employment trends. We're always going to have massive biases in who does the parenting and who does not, who cleans the gutters, who does the social calendar, all of that sort of stuff. I think you just cannot get away from it. You're always going to have to be running, oh yeah, men and women are different, except when we're doing choices and employment, everything else. And anytime you've got an exception, it's like an incongruence. It's just so much safer and better to just deny that gender exists at all. And I know that's wrong. It's just better. The exceptions are if we're doing something that is to do with our physical body sex, like breastfeeding or giving birth, that's pretty gendered, arguably. Or if we are, as feminists or as gender interested people, if we are critically analyzing how gender plays out in this world, we need to pay attention to gender. And if we need to target a specific group, then maybe we need to target programs that are more likely to be in their language or whatever, if we're doing a behavior change program or whatever. But almost the entire rest of the time, I actually think that you don't have to agree, but I actually think there's a benefit in sort of intentionally being in denial about alleged gender differences. What are your thoughts? Gender separate spaces? Benefits, drawbacks?
Yeah, I agree with all of that. But I'd like to put a couple of curlier ones to you. What's your opinion about same-sex schools, where there are arguments that in general boys and girls develop in different areas at different times, and therefore it's to their benefit that they're separated. Like, for example, it could be the same argument. I mean, do we put all the smart kids in one class and the dumber ones in another class because the dumber ones are holding back the development of the smart kids, and the dumber ones need more attention, and we can bring them up to speed in a different way? So there's that. And the other curly one, obviously, is the sport thing, where that, like, you've got women's tennis and men's tennis, and if you didn't have that separation, the way sport would operate would be radically different, and probably not to everyone's benefit.
Beautiful. Love the questions. Thank you. First one on gender separate schools. It seems to me there is some support for gender separate schools being a little better for girls in some ways, and it's not clear as to whether there's a benefit there for boys. That's, I'm not a specialist in this area, but that's my loose understanding on stuff. For me personally, I think that if there are some specific benefits in specific areas, the disbenefit that is not mentioned is that the major lesson that those students are losing in really badly is the ability to mix with genders other than their own. And I think that is a crucial and important life skill, way above and beyond 3 percentage points in maths or 3 percentage points in English lit, which is the sort of level of difference that I think I've been seeing, or something like that. With that said, a point that has been suggested, which would be just better for everyone, and which at first glance seems like a great idea to me, it comes from the perspective, essentially it's just saying start boys 1 year later. It's saying boys mature later than girls do, and almost all of the problems that are associated with girls and boys in the classroom, competitive whatever, or boys getting in the way, boys will be boys, all that sort of stuff, it's all addressed by simply starting boys as a matter of policy 1 year later. And I would say, I don't know, I can't say that it's because boys actually mature later. I think if you go back to the example of the plastic dolls, genderless dolls swaddled in blue, swaddled in pink, I think if you were actually able to create a science experiment where we actually treated everyone equally, I think it's possible. I don't know, because no experiment exists. But I think it's possible that we'd find that that maturity gap, let's call it, may or may not exist. But since it seems to exist at the moment, this is where we find ourselves, then I think that idea of starting boys 1 year later looks kind of good, or possibly brilliant. And I hate to say it, I'm going to think about it more later, but I'm going to sidestep the question about sports. It's just, I am so far from having any clue about sport. I think it's one of those rare moments where, as a older white guy, I might refrain from having an opinion that I don't know something about. I know in almost every other aspect of life, it's great if I could just keep talking regardless, more loudly, but I think on this occasion I'm not going to. But I love the question. Thank you. I've got a few more thoughts about sport as it relates to sex and or gender. I just want to flag, I want to put a few thoughts out, and I'm going to address trans issues in just a second. So just hold on that one. So yeah, confirming in response to this excellent comment or question, confirming sport is a physical thing. It's to do with, it's a physical activity, not a psychological activity, or at least not principally. So it's to do with our physical sex. So there is some sense in sex separation. It's a crude but effective way of achieving a balance between skill levels that makes it more interesting for participants and observers, or something like that. Apologies, talking about sport, I'm so out of my wheelhouse here. So yes, separating sport by sex is crude but effective, but Like with everything else in life, or maybe almost everything else, there is more difference within groups than there is between groups. So let me expand on that for a second. Imagine human quality. Let's go with like nurturing, one's ability to be nurturing. And so imagine plotting on a chart. You can use a chart or a graph, whatever your visualizes well for you. I'm just imagining a really simple chart that tracks people that are not very nurturing through to people that are very nurturing. And imagine that we have separated that by genders. What you would see is some kind of a standard chart or a bell curve spread of humanity, where there'd be a peak of people approximately in the middle or the mean, dropping down on either side to smaller numbers on the fringes of people who are either extremely nurturing or not very nurturing at all. Now, if you were to overlay, and we're just talking in the gender binary here, if you were to overlay your chart of, say, women with your chart of, say, men, you would probably notice a difference around the median. Now, they would be slightly offset from the other. And so you could say, well, there you go, men and women are different. But what you want to notice there is that difference between the two groups is only going to be very small. There's actually much, much more overlap between the two groups that we're looking at. They've got much more in common than they do in difference. When we look back to the example of sport, if we imagine sport at, say, the Olympic level, we are looking just at the top 1% of 1% of 1% of sports people or something like that. And at those extreme margins of the data, differences are massively amplified. The differences between sexes is going to look more dramatic. So maybe there is an example, particularly because that is a physical sex activity, maybe there is more support for the crude but effective approach of separating sexes for sport. I get it. However, you are probably not 1% of the 1% of the 1%. Most people that are playing sport in some capacity are nowhere near that category of person. So if we're looking at this on an individual player level, and if what we are wanting to seek is a reasonably good skill match between people, then that is precisely what we should be seeking. So for instance, I don't know, imagine you're playing, I used to play squash when I was a teenager, so let's go with that. Imagine you're playing a game of squash. What you want from that is to be up against someone who is a pretty good skill match for yourself. So you could separate people by sex and just assume that all people that identify as women are going to be happy playing against people that identify as women, and people that identify as men are going to be happy playing against men, but it's a pretty crude metric. It's so much better, and this is what happens formally and informally. People find people to play against who are a reasonably good skill match for where they are at. So I suggest that, as it is most of the time when we just use sex or gender as a crude shortcut to address differences, it's just that. It's incredibly crude. We're much better off when we burrow into the detail and get more granular on our data. Okay, let's talk about the transgender issue. So I made a joke about this is not the time for an old white guy to comment on the matter. And I stand by that. It's really not. I just want to expand a little on my reasoning behind that. And just in case you managed to miss this debate, the issue is if someone was a man but now is a woman, can they then play in women's sport? Is that fair on the other women? Is the debate that's playing out. And just as a curious, interesting little side note, it is interesting that you almost never hear of this issue in the reverse, but that's another time. What I want to say about this is just that it is a super important issue. I would love to dedicate time to this, but here now in this format, the matter itself is not resolved within the sports community, within the trans community, within other communities. I most definitely don't have an opinion. I would be absolutely willing and enthusiastic to sit in my lounge room and facilitate a gentle, loving conversation with affected parties around this. That is something I would be willing to enter into, but I think me just throwing whatever half-baked thoughts I've got on the topic out in a format like this is disrespectful. So yeah, I don't know the answer to that issue. I have love and care for everyone involved in it, and I hope it resolves as peacefully and quickly as it can. But yeah, I'm going to leave it there for the moment and get back to the content. And just as we slide back in that direction, hey, did you notice the internalized sexism in my joke about myself?
I just wanted to throw a idea in relation to the perfect experiment about treating everyone equal doesn't exist. I think we might be able to find anecdotal evidence in First Nations and various Indigenous and non-Western populations and cultures where there are very drastically different approaches and ideologies to sex and gender differences. I can't bring them up specifically in mind right now, but I know there is, especially in thinking about the diverse sexualities, there are populations or cultures that see third genders, third sexes as a natural, normal part of the social and human experience. So yeah, I think you have mentioned this in the podcast, maybe later on at some point, that a lot of the problems and challenges we are talking about is very Western and post-colonial, the residues of the world we live in. There might be solutions in non-Western and the cultures.
Nice. Again, I don't profess to be any kind of expert, and I think there's a real, I'm fundamentally skeptical about when people in, let's say, developed or First World Nations look back and draw conclusions and use Indigenous or previous cultures as if I was there, as if I know what I'm talking about. So I should really want to stress, I do not know what I'm talking about. At a casual glance, it seems to me we can see a bewildering array of examples of how gender plays out in different communities, from a much more extreme form of gender separateness right through to gender smushing. So at certain times in the evolution of a community or according to certain needs, people might actually swap roles because it's better from a community sense for them to do so. Yeah, I agree with you. It seems to me there's an incredible array of examples out there that we could be drawing from. Thanks.
So maybe this is like a subset of what you're talking about, but I was trying to think of the benefits of exclusive spaces. And the first thing that came to mind was when you think of in a non-gendered context, support groups like Narcotics Anonymous, they try and have everyone in the room needs to have a lived experience of this. And part of that is just that you can have that kind of peer supports without kind of a sense of shame. I did think actually that might not be true, because I think it isn't you can go to an NA meeting if you don't have a history of that. And then I was trying to think of other exclusive spaces, and there's, I suppose religion. I mean, there's certain parts of Mecca that if you're not a Muslim, you just can't even go there. And I think part of that is to just get a cohesiveness in the community and kind of an investment in it. And I mean, not that we ever want to look at religion as a model for how to do things, but I feel like I respect that. And if they want their own space, then I'm happy to stay out of there. I don't know. I guess your thoughts are...
Yeah, great. Great, thanks. Oh, quite a few juicy bits in there, actually. I think maybe like something like oftentimes when we create gender separate spaces, we're working to the assumption that everyone of a particular gender has had the same experiences as us. Therefore, we will have a lot in common. And I think in some ways that's true. And oftentimes it's not. I think the example of something like a Narcanon group is really great because it's like, yeah, everyone in this group has a shared common experience of a relationship with those particular substances or something like that. So I think that's a really good example of a finite pinpoint thing. Also, it's not a forever group. Well, maybe there's some debate around that, but it's not like an intention of I'm going to identify firmly with this group and be a part of this group forever. Which is where I think, I guess I'm about to say something which I know I'm going to regret saying, or at least I'm going to wish that I'd said it differently. I think I'm opposed to every form of us and them that I can think of. So I think I'm opposed to every, we sometimes talk about this as tribal identity, and the word tribal has problems. I think I'm opposed to every time we identify and lock on to being a part of a particular group. I think that is what takes us towards war and difference the entire time. Anytime we start to say things like, well, I am like this and I'm a part of this group of people over here and we are different to that group of people over there, sometimes that tenuously works. But like, I don't know if you've heard, there have actually been some religious wars over time. And I think that is an almost inevitable extension. I think religions are oftentimes a sense of we are like this, we are right, everyone else is over there and they are wrong. And it just seems to wind up in getting a little bit of a tussle about the details of those beliefs or who's got the right to have access to a particular part of land or whatever. I think those are all really good examples of leaning into difference and separateness and us and them and othering, as is in a lot of cases, gender. So I think, and this is the bit where I'm a bit worried that I'm going to want to have said this in better words, but I think I'm opposed to all forms of us and them. I think there's a utility in something like a Narcanon group coming together to work on that particular thing for a particular period of time. I know that a lot of gender groups come together to work on what they think is a particular thing for a particular period of time, but then they wind up staying there more or less forever. Those groups tend to have the perspective, they tend to adopt the perspective that that thing that they've been working on is kind of exclusive to their gender. Like, for example, the Me Too movement, the original person that came up with Me Too, in their words, as best I remember them, and I'm apologizing if I misrepresent them, they said, this movement, my statement, is to reflect that 1 in 4 women have been raped. I think their word was raped as opposed to assaulted. I forget the detail. And 1 in 6 men have been raped or assaulted, whatever that word was. That was their original intention. The Me Too movement quickly became a thing that was only about women for women. And a lot of the people within that movement would say, well, yeah, rape and sexual assault is a women's experience. So that's how that divisiveness and separateness and lack of connection between groups starts to get entrenched when we do that work in gender separate spaces. Whereas if one was to run a support space for people who have experienced sexual assault, although there's definitely going to be gendered patterns in some ways as to how that plays out, if you just specified this is about sexual assault, what do you know? Let me do some quick maths here. Oh, yeah, right. No, it's simple. 40% of people might be male and 60% of people in that group might be female. But one of the incredible benefits from that is it won't contribute to the gender war. It will allow both parties to see, wow, we're all getting screwed over here. There are gendered patterns to it. And we need to look at them specifically, but it's not us against them. So I think I'm against any us and them group ever, always.
Yeah.
I'm just like so skeptical because I just know that anytime I speak in extremes like that, in absolutes of never this and always that, I just know that that's almost always wrong. Almost always wrong. Yeah. That's my thoughts.
Thanks for your response.
I just wanted to quickly say to Tom's thing, like, I love the magnanimous, generous space of, oh, if there was somewhere in Mecca that I couldn't go into as a non-Muslim, that's fine. And I sit there going, yeah, that's fine. Because I don't personally want to go there. I'm okay with not going there. What if it's the space that has the food? What if it's the space that I have to go into to reach heaven or whatever else my beliefs might be? Like, that's when it gets problematic. At a place where I'm happy going, oh, you can have your space. I'm totally happy with that. It's because I don't want it. It's because I don't need to be in that space for my health, for my sanity, for my social status, whatever else it is, for my religion. The ease of not wanting to be, to be able to say, oh, I let them have their space because they need it. I think, and because my first response when Tom said, oh, that's beautiful. Yeah, I feel like that. And then went, shit, no, I don't. Not if it's something that's important to me. Not as in important to my needs, to my desires. So I just wanted to stir that up. And I'm doing this to myself to sort of go, oh God, this is acky yucky. What do I feel about it?
But, yeah, it's tricky. Tom, you can speak to this if you want. I don't imagine Tom was saying, I love the gender differences, the way they're played out and socialized in various religions around the world. But yeah, if people want to have their spaces, they should be able to.
I guess I'd say the answer to that is like, yeah, if you wanted the food, you need to become a Muslim. Yeah. But, you know, I don't think I can like choose my gender. So it's about the price of admission, really, and how invested you are.
Absolutely. And I think just looking into that and where we each sit with it is a massive part of this puzzle.
I would also think of like in Melbourne, there's very, very predominantly like LGBT parties. And like, yeah, I feel like too, that's another one where like, yeah, I mean, can you exclude certain people from that? And there's a lot of like non-LGBT parties that those people can go to. And yeah, it's like I totally respect the need for that kind of like space just for us kind of thing, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one's love this conversation. I think there's a little bit of a difference in people that are interested in a particular sexual orientation or identity, which I can like absolutely see the need for. That doesn't to me sit in contrast to not creating gender separate spaces for the sake of it. But I can see that in that example, they really overlap. And yeah, one of the core problems we need to sort out there first is creating a world which is not so hostile towards LGBTQI folks. And when the world is less hostile, groups have less need to create safer spaces for themselves. So I wouldn't start with gender denialism. I would treat that as an end goal. But yeah. Okay, so having had the luxury of a little further time to think on this, I'd like to clarify my thoughts a little. And essentially, I want to pose this to you as a question, but let me set it up first. Let me establish the background. It sounds here, from the way I was talking during the recording, that I'm saying there should be no separate spaces whatsoever, that there should be no cultural separation, or at least it could sound like that. Look, put simply, that has to be wrong. Like, of course, it's got to be the case that people with special interests or special cultural practices or beliefs or people with hobbies and everything else that makes life special, we have to be able to get together and celebrate what it is that makes us special and unique and all those sorts of things and gather with other people like that. That's got to be right. So getting rid of niche groups and areas of specialization, you know, can't be the answer. And it's not. It's not what I'm proposing. However, perhaps it's true to say that all groups start out as innocent celebrations of who they are and sort of enjoyment of their difference. And perhaps it's true to say that all of them are at risk of radicalizing at some stage on their journey. And at some stage, that sort of innocent celebration of difference escalates to something that causes harm and damage. Let me give you a couple of examples. Example one would be if we zoom out to the level of countries, as in nation states, there can be something lovely about a little bit of national pride, and most countries appeal to that whenever they can internally. But then at some point in time, that starts to become border patrols, starts to become wars, and it starts to become racism. Next example might be with religions. And I don't know if this needs much explaining, but it's normally just a hop, skip, and a jump from, well, we're coming together because we love our God. It's a hop, skip, and a jump to then saying all other gods are wrong. And then it's a hop, skip, and a jump to saying, well, we have to kill other believers in other gods. Next example might be something to do with sports ball. And at first glance, this would seem to be really innocuous. And in a lot of ways it is. But people get passionate about their sports ball teams to the point of riots, stampedes, murders. You get violence between parents at their kids' games. Yeah. And my last example is circling back around to gender as a point of difference. So, like, on the one hand, it's wonderful to celebrate your gender and to have pride and identity and some self-worth that's tied to your gender. These are all great things. On the other hand, we are in a gender war and people are dying because of their gender. So my question to you, and also to myself, but my question to you is, what exactly is the line that gets crossed when a group shifts from being an innocent celebration of difference to one that is in a position to cause harm and damage? And follow-up question to that is, how does a group stay on the good side of that line? How do we as individuals celebrate our differences and gather with people like us, but not start to slip over the line and start to inadvertently cause harm? I would love to hear your thoughts. And in fact, if you can make it to the next live recording, we're going to. My best answer to this for myself is that any group I'm in needs to have constant vigilance around not othering the other side. So the only groups I've ever seen manage to do this and not slip into dangerous territory are very active about not othering other people. And they're not kind of getting drunk on their difference. I don't mean drunk as in alcohol or whatever. I mean, there is almost an altered state you can get into when you're hanging out with people like yourself, and you can sort of get drunk and carried away. You can get drunk on that a little bit and get carried away with that. So I think it takes awareness to keep that in check. The groups that I'm thinking of make sure that they always speak about people who are not present, groups that are not present, or in this case, genders that are not present, in positive terms. And you can sort of, there's a nice little test you can do of that around, you know, you've got your group of specialty. Can you still get along with people from other groups? I think if you can't, that might be evidence that you're over a line. When it comes to the gender war and gender separate spaces and celebrating our gender differences, I feel that the stage we're at the moment is definitely not like that. The gender war is nasty, and the ways we speak to each other throughout the gender war are nasty. So this is why I identify as pan-political. So I do care about the issues that affect me personally because of my gender or sex, whatever way you want to look at that, you know, the ways that I've presented to the world, the ways that I've been socialized, the privileges that I have, the privileges that I don't have, structural advantages and disadvantages. It's important to look into that stuff. It's important to me, but not to the exclusion of others. And when I'm looking at those issues as they affect me, it's crucially important that I don't let that build into anger and hatred at other people or other genders. For me, I think the only way to actually ensure that this is the case is to intentionally not put myself in gender separate spaces. Like, to me, this pattern, this kind of slippery slope from an innocent celebration through to something which is at genuine risk of causing harm, that pattern became apparent to me in my, I don't know, let's say mid-20s. And prior to that, I was putting myself in gender separate spaces, even ones that were very careful about wanting to do the right thing. But it just happens anyway. Groups get one-sided, they get a little carried away, they lose those checks and balances, and before you know it, you've got an us and them situation. So for me, the only real way to ensure this is to, yeah, not put myself in gender separate spaces. And I've also taken the emphasis off my gender, and I got to say, it's been a great thing. If nothing else, it ensures that I'm not creating division or one-sidedness or anger and hatred. It ensures that people with different opinions and different understandings and reflections are a part of my awareness and my self-perception. And also, life goes on. I got to say, diversity is better. Yeah, I get it. There can be like a real joy in celebrating difference, but I got to say in this case, and I can only speak for myself, diversity is better. Beautiful, gang. Thank you so much for your important thoughts on this. And I guess I mean that to the people that are gathered here now in this Zoom call. And I also mean all the people in my life and around the world that have contributed to these thoughts and these ideas over the 25, 30 years around me that I've been looking into this, and more broadly, all of these conversations everywhere. I had intended to have a little bit of a chat with Inga and Emma. Inga unexpectedly couldn't make it today, and time has been a thing. But Emma, thank you so much for more than enabling, like enthusing, critiquing, contributing, creating, enabling, and being a support through this material, and Inga as well. I want to do a quick shout out. There's a sort of a, effectively like a reading group in Gover in Spain. Get together and have a little discussion group after every episode. Just want to do a quick shout out to them. Thank you so much, gang. It has been a pleasure. Go well into the world. And yeah, love to all.
Thanks so much.
Thanks. Thanks so much for putting this together, Rob.
I'm running a course called A Therapist's Guide to Sexuality, Taboos, and Kink, with Process Work International. It's designed with therapists in mind, by which I mean any one-to-one practitioner who wants to know more about the world of sexuality so as to be able to better support your clients that are exploring that world. It'll tackle a whole bunch of juicy topics, like how to pick positively and therapeutically beneficial forms of play from ones that might be damaging or concerning. It addresses why people pursue these areas of interest in the first place, and what you can do to support them towards safe and well-paced experimentation, even if you yourself have got little or no interest in such things. The course is pitched at therapists of various descriptions, but will also be of relevance to people seeking a solid grounding in best practice exploration of their sexuality. It runs for 3 2-hour sessions by Zoom, starting on September the 9th, 2025. Links are in the show notes, and also on the Curious Creatures website. Love to see you there. How about that capitalism, huh? I want to talk with you about a weird way that capitalism is actually kind of functional. It's to do with this podcast. Firstly, I want to stress it's okay for you to just listen to this and not contribute. I say just listen because it's not nothing. By just listening to it, you're engaging with my material, you're probably having chats about it with others, and really, that's all I'm doing this for. I can tell that you are there because I can see you in the total number of downloads, and it means a lot to me.
This relationship works for me. It's okay to just listen. At the same time, I know that some of you want to show a more active level of support and are in a position to do so. This is where capitalism comes into it and doesn't actually do a half bad job. I've set up a Patreon page, which, in short, is an easy way for you to contribute. And it's very meaningful to me. I used to be skeptical about paying for podcasts, but eventually I had to ask myself how it differs from paying for books, or for videos, or for workshops, or for therapy, all of which I pay for pretty consistently. And this, my friends, is my version of a book, or a workshop, or a whatever. So I feel okay about asking for a donation through Patreon, if you're in a position to do so, and this has been meaningful for you. So the link is in the show notes and also on the Curious Creatures website. If you're not in a position to contribute, please don't feel guilty about listening to this for free. I appreciate you, and I appreciate having you on this ride with me.